Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 18th of December 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we do have with us once again Horus from BitChute. Horus, a good day, sir. Good evening. How are you doing anyway?
Good evening, Sven. Yeah, thanks for having me on again. I'm doing all right. I'm very happy to be finished working for Christmas now, so that's a load off.
Oh, excellent, so, yeah. Excellent. You must be in a good mood. I'm in a good mood because I do enjoy doing these podcasts with you, and I think we've got some really good subject matter that we've covered in the last couple of weeks, and we're going to get into more of that today, obviously, covering the Culture of Critique series. But just before we get into that, I was thinking about what we were doing and how I'm hoping that people wouldn't accuse us of hate speech, but just in case people do get confused and are wondering about the subject matter that we're covering and could it be misconstrued as hate speech, I thought I'd just write some of my thoughts down. And this is what I came up with. The Public Order Act and subsequent legislation restricting speech was based upon the Stephen Lawrence case, where it was discovered that his killers had allegedly been sitting around at home talking about how they would like to find someone black and kill them. This sort of speech was not against the law at the time, so the law was changed to be able to prosecute incitement to hate, meaning incitement of hatred to the level where someone might carry out a violent act. Hate crime entrepreneurs have since then sought to expand the law into meaning any criticism at all of groups with protected characteristics. What we are doing here, however, is not even criticising the Jews for their behaviour as a group, as it can be shown to have benefited them as a group and appears to be more on the instinctive level with them than a wide-ranging and convoluted conspiracy. It is even reflected in their religious teachings, so it is obviously an essential part of their being, and it would be wrong to try and change that. What we are doing here is analysing it and discussing it so that people are aware of these currents in our society and can do their best to protect themselves from them on the one hand and work for our own people group's benefit by advocating for counter-strategies on the other. This is not hate speech, as there is no intent to incite hatred here. To the contrary, in fact, we believe that Jews' success within host nations proves that by sticking to your own group's traditions and by advocating for what is best for them, that group will triumph in the resource competition that results in multicultural societies. Therefore, we should not be emulating the Jews' strategies, but reviving our own. And I think there are those are some quite important points to make. I don't know if you have any comments on that, Horace.
I think what we're doing is in accordance with our ancient rights and traditions as Englishmen and in accordance with our ethnic interests. So I fully agree with your opening statement.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, that really bears saying as well, that it is our tradition and our rights to discuss things. That goes right back to... there's a bit in Acts where St. Paul is accused of saying something. He says, well, we can but speak what we see and hear, which means that we have to be able to say what we see happening around us, regardless of if it hurts people's feelings or whatever. It's an essential part of being a human, is to be able to reinterpret what you see around you and explain your ideas about that, your analysis of that. And, of course, that's what we're doing here, and we're tying it in with Professor Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique series, where he analyses Jews as a group and their group strategies for thriving within host societies. And looking through Culture of Critique today, I mean, it is just absolutely fascinating when you think about it. Jews as a group, and he comes up with all these examples of it. And he explains through history different examples of it, and you can see that Jews are all doing the same thing. They're all advocating for their own people, and it almost becomes predictable. And it is fascinating because it is almost like a hive mind, because then they can't all be conspiring together to do these things. And yet, whenever they have a chance to have an influence, that influence will be to benefit them. And it may not always look like that at first glance. And the great thing about Kevin MacDonald is he breaks it down. So to get to what's really going on there, to find out what the Jews are really doing and how these things like the psychoanalysis movement, the anti-immigration movement, even pro-homosexuality and pro-abortion movements, it breaks them down as to how they benefit them. And we even had converso Jews in the 15th and the 16th century that were in Spain that were introducing these ideas into Christianity that were basically subverting Christianity. And he breaks that down as how that was benefiting them. So they've done this all throughout history. They have worked to advance their own cause. And there's nothing wrong with that. That the problem today is that we have stopped doing that. That's why one of the reasons why it's fascinating to look at the way that the Jews have behaved in history. And I'm not condemning them for that. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that, Boris.
Well, the one bit that I probably would condemn, I think by implication I agree with everything else you said, but the one bit that really does feel offensive to me, I guess we sort of touched on a similar thing last week, is just the attempt to demonize and prohibit us from doing likewise for ourselves, which does seem to be a part of Jewish ethnic activism. Perhaps not something that all Jews would support, but it is something that Jewish organizations seem to lead in. And that does seem to me, maybe I'm putting it too strongly if I say, I don't know, murderous, as in like that seems to be an attempt to finish us off or to see us gone. I think, you know, among the very worst of Jewish activism, it is motivated like that. In others, you know, in other cases, maybe it's motivated by paranoia or neurosis. But that's one thing that I would say is not legitimate for them to do. I really, really take offence at that.
Well, I think they see it as Jewish exceptionalism, don't they? This is for thee, but it's not for me. And when you think about it, it's, you know, it's a dog eat dog world, isn't it? And I think they see it as kill or be killed. And they're very, very paranoid. Perhaps, you know, you could say rightly so. I mean, they have been expelled from 190 different countries. So they are very paranoid about this. And I think, you know, you can see this with their hoarding of the nuclear weapons and not telling us, you know, not even admitting that they have them. But they are very paranoid, and I think they do have that mentality of it's dog eat dog, it's kill or be killed. If we don't make our way to the top, they will, and they'll get rid of us all when they get there.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems that perhaps that's more the way that they see it than the average white person does, or European. But something that's very interesting that I think MacDonald touches on and Douglas Reid talks about in the controversy of Zion as well is that there have been times and places where Jews began to, well, not just began to, went quite a long way to assimilating into the Gentile society. As far as I can tell, genuinely, I mean, the biological differences won't just disappear, but there was genuine assimilation on the part of many Jews, certainly in Germany before the First World War. In Britain, to some extent, some of the Sephardi Jews, probably some of the Ashkenazis who've moved in more like in the last 150 years into Britain. But there are also within sort of Jewry as a whole forces that very like careful, like I don't know, calculatedly work to prevent and reverse that. That's something I think MacDonald talks about maybe both in Separation and Cultural Critique. Did you find that interesting? Because I think that's a really important part of the picture, that there is a struggle between Jews to stop, because that, you know, assimilation is a threat. I know we've already talked about this on previous week's shows, but it's I think it's significant because it shows the diversity of Jews and their thinking, and there are plenty of them who actually don't want this hostility and don't want it to be dog eat dog. You know, they don't want it to be us and them. They genuinely do believe that there can be some mixing or meeting. Whether that's a good thing, you know, is kind of subjective, but in my opinion, I am up for, you know, those of them who want to live peaceably among us, like it doesn't have to be a problem that they're Jewish, you know. And that, because of that, I think it's all the more sad that there's these other forces that are constantly trying to frighten other Jews into thinking that every you know, self-assertiveness, ethnic assertiveness of whites is a mortal threat to them. I think that's really sad.
That's the biggest problem, isn't it? You know, any sign of ethnocentrism on the part of white nations, non-Jewish nations, that's it. They want to stamp down on it straight away. That's the source of all these insults we get called white supremacists, racists, neo-Nazis. All of that is out of this fear of ethnocentrism rising in non-Jews. Whereas that is exactly what they do for themselves. They encourage it as much as they can. And I was just thinking then of the counterforce to these Jews that want to assimilate. But then you get not non-Jews in society that see the Jews that do assimilate, and then they see the influence that these assimilated Jews push into society, and it's a Jewish influence, and there's a pushback against that. So even that in itself can be a cause of anti-Semitism. I mean, essentially, I think we're just not all meant to live together in multicultural societies. It's not of benefit to anyone. It's much better for people to live in ethnically homogenous societies, especially over periods of time, where they then get to grow into the shape of their nation, their specific shape of their nation, which will have a different culture, different ways of doing things to all the other nations in the world. And that fascinates me. That is what really fascinates me about the world, basically, is the different peoples that we have and the different cultures that grow from these different peoples and from these different nations. And when you have all these nations living together in one, it destroys all of that. But the Jews do seem to benefit from it because they don't stand out, and it gives them a chance to rise to the top. And they promote the idea that everybody's got to get along to everybody else. But to themselves, they say, well, no, we're separate to that. We're Jews. We keep to our own. We marry within our own. We have our own religion, and you have a lot of nepotism between them, where they will help other Jews out. Whereas if we were to do something like that, we would obviously be accused of racism. I mean, we're accused of racism as it is because we don't have blacks and non-whites involved in all the different levels of industry. And but at the same time, when you see Jewish industries or Jewish businesses, it's all Jews that are at the top. When you look at the media as well, when they say, well, television and film, they say, well, we need to get, it's far too white in here. They don't actually include the number of Jews that are in there. I mean, they must make up about 60% of the media. I think Kevin McDonald looks at the percentage that they are in the media, and it was about 60% back in 2000 in Hollywood and television.
Yeah, and that's deliberate, obviously, that use of the dual identity, white when it suits them sort of thing. That's clearly deliberate and cynical, and that's another thing that I think, well, I'm sure McDonald would agree, that's one of the stimulants of anti-Semitism. Maybe we've discussed this in previous weeks, but I like the way he uses anti-Semitism. He doesn't say, you know, he doesn't try to dodge it or anything. He's saying, but fine, let's use this term. The etymology of the word is very, very unsatisfactory, but whatever, let's work with it and let's understand it. And that is the basis of especially Separation and Its Discontents, and also the trilogy as a whole. And I think that's the right way to go about it. You know, conceding the word itself is annoying, and that's something to be examined, but his approach is very intelligent. But I agree with what you said, like that. You know, the blending of all the other races except the Jews, which you know, some large portion of, I'd say, Jews further up the hierarchy, as it were, seem to pursue, and which seems to go hand in hand with Zionism. I think that's actually part of what Zionism really means. It's not just having Israel; it's having Israel and blending or dissolving all the other nations. Right? I think that's really, really what it means. That's what most Zionists really envision. It's a form of global Jewish supremacy. I think that's really what lies at the core of Zionism, and I think that is the motivation of most of the people driving it. So I completely agree that, like, yeah. So I mean, you said that as sort of a counter to the idea of assimilation. When I speak of assimilated Jews, I am talking about what appears to me to be a pretty small minority. So you mentioned that there may be Jews who assimilate, but then we begin to see again that they behave in this sort of Jewish anti-European way, and that, you know, despite claiming to be of the nation, they are in fact still really of the Jewish nation, the global nation somehow. I agree that does happen. My use of assimilated was not really meant to include those people. It was meant to include only, I'm really thinking of just a few Jews who I know who do live like British people. I mean, obviously I can tell the different, I know their different ancestry, so I know that they're different, but I think of one in particular who refers to themselves as English, and not in the insidious way, not in the way of saying my fellow English people, we must accept refugees. It's not like that. This person actually really does hate what's being done to Britain and thinks it's horrible and terrible, just doesn't appreciate that it's being done by members of the same tribe, unfortunately. But that discussion's ongoing. But that person that I'm thinking of, I accept that is rare, maybe less than 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 1,000. But I do appreciate those few who do sort of genuinely adopt the identity of the nation they live in, it seems to me. And I lament at the same time what I see, which is them being, in a way, terrorised by other Jews and being told that there's this ever-growing threat of anti-Semitism. It's just a cliche now, but it's, how could it be rising all the time? That means just a straight line upwards. I mean, it's ridiculous. not to become too cucked, but I do think it's an interesting dynamic that there are Jews who want to become, I accept that they're probably a small minority, but they want to become part of the nations they live in, and they have to be sort of corralled like a herd by those who see themselves as the shepherds of the global Jewish nation.
I think the Zionists were really worried about that, weren't they? That was one of the reasons why Zionism arose. They were very concerned about Jews becoming too German.
And Herzl said it specifically. Yeah, we are being absorbed and we're going to disappear, sort of thing. Yeah.
So they have a rightful fear of this existential threat of being absorbed by the other nations. But so do we. This is the thing. We also have an existential threat around us, which is caused by diversity and multiculturalism, which is of great benefit to them. But of course, it's not a great benefit to them in their own nation of Israel. And I think the fact they have Israel has totally changed the dynamic, really. And when you point out there about Zionism, that's really international Zionism, isn't it? It's Zionists within other countries. If you just had Zionism and it was in Israel, it would be the same as everybody else's nationalism. But because they have this nationalism within other people's countries that is loyal to their country, which is often at odds with the country that they're living in, then it's different. I mean, as a European nationalist, I feel solidarity with other European nationalists, but that doesn't put me at odds against the country that I'm living within. It means that I'm trying to advance the cause of the country that I live in and also the cause of my people worldwide. Again, it's because we have two different peoples living together that we get these problems, and they've developed all these strategies over these years to cope with these problems, and part of it has been starting these political movements, these ideological movements that on the surface of them, they talk about liberation and freedom and freedom for the people from oppression. But what they're really about is steering these movements to prevent anti-Semitism and prevent criticism of the Jews till we get to the stage where we're at now, where it's legislated against. In the Soviet Union, it was a capital offence for criticising Jews. And in actual fact, that's where we really got to at the end of last week. What we were saying is there a stage that they get to where their group strategies that have served them well all the time that they were a small minority without that much power, but once they get to a position of much power and much influence in society, could it be that those strategies actually start having negative effects on them? Things such as Muslims attacking them in the streets, or their own children marrying out and marrying Arabs and marrying blacks, or their own children becoming homosexual and falling for the propaganda that they've encouraged amongst the nations that they live among. And also when they were in the Soviet Union, Russia is a very rich country. It's full of resources, and yet they ended up bankrupting the country. Once they were in a position of power, their strategies of being at odds against the people, instead of causing that country to do really well, once they got to the top, it destroyed the country, didn't it? So all of this says to me, it's just natural to them. It's innate within them. And they would be a danger to themselves once they get right to the top in a society. And this is why it's going to be so interesting to see really what happens with Israel, because it does rely a lot on aid, doesn't it? It doesn't really produce enough to keep its own people, as far as I'm aware, anyway.
Yeah, that's an interesting question about how much Israel actually relies upon Western aid. I mean, for a small country, it does get a lot of money. Yeah, it does get, well, it's several billion a year just from the US, right? I mean, this, I don't know really the size of the Israeli economy. I know, like, for its region, it is actually one of the wealthiest. But, the sort of, I guess you were, if I'm correct, you were alluding to a sort of potentially entropic effect of Jewish activism, as in when it passed a certain stage of influence of power, like sort of passed up above a certain level of that, do they kind of lose their minds and begin to do things that will destroy them? I think so. I think yes. And I think Zionism is a mad, like, if it is as I described, and it involves not only having, you know, a state of their own, but also dissolving all the other countries of the world, really, or bringing them all under control of Jerusalem. I think that is a mad vision. Whether it can be, I mean, I doubt it could be achieved anyway. And even if it was, I don't think that they would have the sort of bliss that they imagine. I think it would be an insane and terrible world, like, where they wouldn't even be happy. They would even then, they would probably find reasons to be frightened of their slaves, I think. I don't think there's any happiness to be found from pursuing that vision. Not that I really wish them any in that regard. Like, I mean, just don't do it. Don't be like that. Just sort of be more human. But yeah, like, when you mentioned the Soviet Union, I think that's one of the areas where McDonald is most interesting. I think it's in Culture of Critique that he discusses it most. The relationship of Jews, because obviously, and the trope of Judeo-Bolshevism is really interesting as well. But obviously, Jews were a major, major part, probably the dominant part of launching the initial coup, of forming the Soviet regime. Personally, I then depart from some people on our side who emphasize the Jewishness of it. I think it diminished the more that Stalin took over. I think that it is significant that Stalin was a Gentile. So when people talk about things like Lazar Kaganovich having caused the whole of the war, I mean, they may, you know, I don't discount that, but I think it is significant that Stalin was the despot. You know, it was at his orders. It was at his behest that happened. It may be the case, though, that Kaganovich deliberately administered it far more cruelly than was necessary. That may well be the case. Maybe Stalin was just asking for tyranny, not genocide. But, you know, it turned into a genocide thanks to Kaganovich. That may be true. But all the same, Stalin was an appalling tyrant, even if you remove all the Jewish elements. But it's very, like what McDonald talks about there is really, really interesting in that the more that it became a Stalinist regime, like Stalin's regime, the less Jews liked it. And Jews were, there's an interesting book by Benjamin Ginsberg, obviously one of the tribe himself, called How the Jews Defeated Hitler. And my video, The Judean-German War, is based partly on that book. Jews were very, very important in the Soviet Union, at least until the end of the Second World War. After that, Stalin obviously decided that he wanted to reassert himself vis-a-vis Jews in the Soviet Union. And this doctor's plot that he launched shortly before he died, presumably of natural causes, was largely aimed at Jews, and a lot of the state propaganda that flowed, you know, from him at that time was deliberately inciting sort of antipathy towards Jews. I don't think it was designed to get anyone massacred or anything, but it was just to diminish their power, you know, relative to the party. I think that was the idea. And not coincidentally at all, people who lived in New York, you know, the group called the New York Intellectuals, which McDonald discusses a lot, and they're mainly the same people who became the neoconservatives and also combined with the Straussians, that's another Jewish cult. Those people were loyal. Well, no, not loyal. They were Trotskyists. They were fervent Trotskyists. And they appear to have come to hate the Soviet Union, even though, I mean, Trotsky had been excluded well before. I think he was exiled in, what, the early to mid-1930s, I think. They tolerated that, I believe. But what they couldn't tolerate was, well, the more overtly anti-Semitic nature of the regime as sort of it went into the 1950s. And they all became anti-communists, but they didn't become conservatives. They, you know, that's why we have this name, neoconservatives. It's not an adequate name, like the word anti-Semitism. It's not, doesn't really suffice to describe what it refers to, but it distinguished them from conservatives because they weren't. They were still radicals. Whether they'd ever really been leftists, whether they now became conservatives, I doubt. But the attitudes of intellectual Jewry in New York and in, you know, and thereby throughout much of America, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, I think that's very indicative. Basically, they decided to support it and then not to support it based on Jewish ethnic interests.
That's really interesting about the neocons there. That's what really woke Dr. E. Michael Jones up to what was going on with the Jews, because he was looking at the neocons and he was thinking, well, what is it that unites them with these other groups? And it was the fact that the majority of them were Jewish and the neocons were Jewish. And it's very interesting to see that they went from supporting Trotsky and being Bolsheviks to then being neocons and being on the right. And because the thing that stayed the same throughout all that time was their loyalty to Jewish group interests. And when you're talking there, go on.
Sorry, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, when you brought up the Jewish idea of the utopia, the Jewish idea of the utopia is the materialist utopia. And it's the opposite of what Europeans would idealize as a utopia. In the Jewish utopia, you're free to have sex with whoever and whatever you want. You're free to do all these things. Whereas, I guess, in the European utopia, you have freedom from the temptation to do those things. And that would be the difference, like quite a fundamental difference, I think.
And yeah, and there's maybe a greater valuing of, I'm not sure exactly, but I mean, yeah, I mean, some people have referred to British people. I don't particularly go along with this, but British people as sort of the Jews of Europe, or like, because British people are very into. I don't know how true this is, but they emphasise that British people have always been into, like, well, not always, but heavily into commerce and finance even, and materialism instead of idealism. When they speak of idealism, they're referring more to Germany. I think German idealism is a strain in philosophy. I can't really speak with any expertise about that. But there was something that you said that I was going to pick up on, but I can't remember what it was.
I would agree with you about the trade there.
Sorry.
I would agree with you about the trade there and the wealth. I think Britain has been more interested in trade and wealth rather than artistic pursuits. If you compare Britain to places like Italy or places like Germany, and I mean, we did build this world empire, but then again, we did have a strong Jewish influence. So did that come from the British people? You can look right back 2,000 years ago. And that's why Rome wanted to invade Britain, was because we were so important to trade and we didn't have any Jews then. So it must be a uniquely British thing.
Ah, I didn't realize actually. I think when people say this, I took it that they were referring to the last couple of hundred years, and they're sort of thinking of it starting with people like Adam Smith, and, you know, like sort of a lot of pro-capitalist philosophy has come out of Britain or has been taken up very enthusiastically by Britain. And so I assumed it was something that referred to sort of, yeah, the last 250 years or so. But that's very interesting. That I was well aware that when the Vikings and the Normans invaded Britain, it was because of the richness of this land. It was like it was already just such a prize for conquest. So I didn't know that went as far back as the Romans. Well,
with the mines, and we had British troops that were in France, and we had French traders that were helping us as well, and they prevented Rome from getting across the first time, and then the second time Caesar had to kidnap all the Roman chiefs and pretty much force them to be aligned with Rome to come and invade Britain. So you pretty much had all the allied forces of Europe it took to come into Britain, because Britain was so important to trade. I mean, it has parallels to today with us breaking away from the European Union, but the importance of us and us being good at trade and producing things that the rest of the world wanted goes back thousands of years. And part of that is because of the tin mines that we had here, which go back, I don't know, 3,000 years, at least 2,500 years. And that tin was needed for the Bronze Age, for the rest of the world, for the whole of the classical world needed our tin. So that I should imagine was the origins of it. But we were still not as, we didn't have usury though. We didn't have usury at all until the Jews came in. So our banking and our trade would have been very different to what it is today. And I suspect that, it was the usury that corrupted it.
And when I think of tin, I think of Cornwall, isn't that a place where there's a lot of tin mines?
Yeah.
I remembered what it was I was going to pick up on about what you said a couple of minutes ago was about with the New York intellectuals and the neoconservatives and the Straussians, especially the neocons, about how they moved to the right. I just wanted to sort of insert there that they are basically a fake right-wing movement. I mean, there are certain conservative values that they do seem to uphold. Even then, I sense that it's just tactical. But one thing that I think is really distinctive about neoconservatives, and I think this has always been the case since whenever they became a thing, the 40s, 50s, whatever, 60s, they've always been extreme pro-immigrationists. There's one neoconservative in particular called Ben Wattenberg, who I've seen on a couple of documentaries and stuff. He wrote a book in the 90s just arguing for the absolute brilliance of the fact that America was, at the time he wrote this, just being flooded by a whole new range of nations who were never in, or whoever never had more than a tiny representation in America. So we're talking like Sudanese, Somalians, Yemenis, we're talking, you know, like obscure and poor places, and basically just pouring in and colonizing the USA. I mean, some of them will be assimilated. I think, raises the question of assimilation again, because I think what people like Ben Wattenberg would envision is that these people maintain their identity vis-a-vis white people, obviously don't assimilate with whites, certainly don't become cordial with whites, remain separate and be somewhat antagonistic, but do assimilate to the state and maybe corporations, like, so the ruling ideology, which Jews like Wattenberg intend to determine. They intend to be part of the ruling elite and to control all these different ethnic groups under them, in which whites will be just one of, you know, hundreds of different groups, and ideally, from his point of view, an ever-shrinking one. And this is something that we've seen again, like this has become a prominent idea again recently with people like Matthew Iglesias and Glenn Beck, who used to be on Fox, used to be considered a wacky right-winger, but they're calling for this 1 billion Americans thing. It's the same vision as what Ben Wattenberg laid out in the 90s. And it's just neoconservatism. Anyone who doesn't see it as just an arm of sort of Jewish interests is not really looking. Just one other person who spoke really interestingly about the neocons was, and he's not a theorist, but Justin Raimondo, who died last year, I think. He was not someone who thought that race should be important. He's not a racialist thinker. He's not one of us, you know, in that sense. But he wrote for a website called antiwar.com. His hero was Murray Rothbard, who was Jewish himself. I also like Murray Rothbard. He's one of my favorite philosophers. But Justin Raimondo would just typically refer to the neocons, or maybe a more broad group that included the neocons, as Israel firsters. And he was obviously attacked as an anti-Semite for this, which is ridiculous, like absolutely ludicrous accusation. But, unless I suppose we're using the word anti-Semite in the less sort of hypersensitive way. He would just refer to the Israel First crowd among you know, journalists and activists and so on. And I just thought that really gets straight to the point. I mean, these are people who live in America, got American citizenship, you know, they've taken up important positions in America, and their loyalty is openly, their first loyalty and maybe their only loyalty is openly to Israel. And I just think, yeah, that just really gets straight to the heart of it. Don't bother with these names like neoconservative, because they're not conservative and there's nothing particularly new about what they're doing, apart from the existence of Israel itself. That is quite, you know, a relatively recent thing. But I just like that sort of formulation, Israel firsters, you could just say Jew firsters or something, or Judaists or something like that. But, you know, just get to the point. It's ethnic activism.
Well, it's amazing, really. I mean, it just shows you how effective their strategies have been, that they've got to the stage where they can have a president in place like Donald Trump, who says to be against Israel is to be against America, who makes legislation that nobody can boycott this other country. They've got it so that in America they can have dual citizenship, and it's bipartisan. Support for Israel is bipartisan. All of this is a testament to their strategies, because when you think Jews have really only been in America for the last 120 years, 130 years, 150 probably at the most, really, in any numbers, these East European Jews, and they've succeeded in rising right to the top. And you can go back further and say, well, it's been since the emancipation of the Jews in the French Revolution, when they were given citizenship and given the same rights as everybody else. And they've really risen up all around the world, but nowhere more so than in America. And, you know, it's not a conspiracy. It's just this is the way that they function. This is why in the past church authorities ended up having to put restrictions on them to prevent that sort of thing from happening, where the rest of the nation would end up just working for the Jews, interests, whether it used to be through banking and through usury, but now it's effectively right there in the government doing Israel's bidding. I mean, nobody knows really what America is doing in Syria or in Libya or in Afghanistan, but it does all benefit Israel. It benefits Israel to have the neighbors around her destabilized. And you're just bringing up the word anti-Semitism there, and I was just going to agree that it is such a good word, because what is Semitism? Semitism is the things that Jews do that we notice, and negative things that they do that we notice, and then therefore you become anti-Semitism. But they change it so that you become anti-Semite. So they try to call you this word, meaning that you're actually against the people themselves, and they say, oh, that's just because they're Jews, rather than saying, well, actually, we're against some of the things that we've noticed that you do as a group, some of these things that aren't naturally the sort of things that Europeans would do, things such as usury or pornography or abortion or feminism, all these things that Kevin MacDonald links to them and shows with lots of evidence that they've had a lot of influence in these ideological movements, the promotion of homosexualism, abortion, feminism, all these sorts of things. And they're not things that would naturally arise amongst Europeans, and there is a resentment there, and we're not happy about that. So we become anti-Semitism, but not anti-Semites. But they've changed the English language so that you can't say that you're anti-Semitism. So I find that interesting. I don't know if you want to comment on that, or I've got a comment, but I've got a quote here by Kevin MacDonald on anti-Semitism.
Yeah, unless there's something that I am missing, or just, you know, some move that I haven't anticipated, I think that the sort of sensible tactical response to that is to refer a great deal to Semitism. This is something we do with the term anti-white as well. Like, we've, you know, it doesn't particularly come naturally from my mouth to say anti-white, or even just to speak of white stuff in general. That was never part of my lexicon, really. Hardly at all, anyway. In the same way, but I've started using it because it does really get to the heart of the matter. Like, there are people who just despise white people. In the same way, I think that we should speak of, I don't know if this is the ideal term, but the Semitic front or something like that. The Semitic forces, like, because the word anti-Semitism currently is used in a way that is just one-sided. It's just this. I mean, the Israeli historian Yehuda Bauer literally argued that anti-Semitism should be spelt without a hyphen and with a small s, all one word, anti-Semitism. And he said the reason is that there is no Semitism to speak of. Now, I agree that we don't commonly use that word, but there's also no such thing, you know, as anti-Semitism if we're speaking literally, because, you know, Semitic means a language group. So, well, they, you know, if they're determined not to say anti-Jewish and specifically to use this word anti-Semitism, then we should respond with the opposite, at least insofar as it sort of helps us defend ourselves by doing so. And obviously that will force them into the awkward and sort of retreating position of having to justify their own use of this term anti-Semitism. And that, you know, putting the focus on that rather than on us and our supposed hatred and our supposed genocidal intent and stuff, that's a win for us. If we can make that commonplace, I mean, it's quite a task, but I think it might work. Maybe it wouldn't for reasons that I can't see, but I think it makes sense to do that, to speak of, you know, the Semitic forces or something. I'm sure, you know, some people will recoil in horror when you do so, but
how about,
I think there's some merit to it.
how about Semitic currents in society?
Talk of Semitic currents.
Yeah. There's talk now of whiteness, isn't there? And particularly black advocates.
Whenever I hear someone talking of whiteness, I just think that person's an enemy.
they talk about it very, very negatively, don't they? It's only ever spoken about in negative terms. But then I guess that Semites could say, well, Semitism is only ever spoken about in negative terms. But if it's okay to talk about whiteness, and that's, you know, that's mainstream, then it should be okay to talk about Semitism, surely.
Yeah, and I think whiteness studies, which is a field alongside, and it's pretty much the same as critical race theory, but whiteness studies really puts a fine point on it in the name. I believe that is a field where all of the leading academics are, I mean, there might be one or two white communists, but I think it's pretty much all blacks or Jews academics who've originated that field. I mean, obviously, Noel Ignatieff is one of the famous ones who died this year or last year. He was, you know, an absolutely, just like absolutely despised our whole race, just openly and proudly and smugly.
So hateful.
But yeah, sorry, say again.
I was just going to say, he was so hateful. Such a hateful person.
Yeah. And proud of his hatred as well. I mean, it's really extreme. I agree that, put the spotlight, you know, back on the people who want to talk in those terms, in those very acutely and accusatorily racial terms that they so want to undo our society, unmake our society. I mean, we'll give some of that back, you know. It doesn't come naturally, but yeah, let's talk about Semitic studies. See, I don't like it. I don't like saying that, but, you know.
Semitic currents isn't quite so, isn't quite so bad as Semitic studies. But, yeah, we should definitely turn their terminology back on them and use their own tactics intellectually, as it were. Mm. Well, I've got a good quote here by Kevin MacDonald on anti-Semitism. He says, "A general point of this volume might be summarised by simply saying that Jews are very good at whatever they do, and that anti-Semitism arises when there are perceived conflicts of interest between the Jewish community, or segments of it, and the Gentile community, or segments of it. Because of Jewish within-group cooperation, as well as eugenic and cultural practices that have resulted in an average IQ of at least one standard deviation above the Caucasian mean," and he gives a separation and discontents chapter 7 that comes from, "Jews are highly adept in achieving their goals, whether the goals involve establishing a homeland in the Middle East, developing business and financial networks, competing for positions in prestigious graduate and professional schools, leading political, intellectual and cultural movements, or influencing immigration policy and the political process. The success of these pursuits, and the fact that these pursuits inevitably conflict with the interests of groups of Gentiles, or are at least perceived to conflict with them, is, in the broadest sense, the most important source of anti-Semitism." And I mean, he gives a very, very long list there of, you know, of examples of where Jews have achieved goals and where they will conflict with the goals of groups of Gentiles. And he gives a reason for it. And I, you know, there's nothing hateful there. It's just a statement of fact, and explains the reason why there is this concept of anti-Semitism. And then it gets used by the Jews as, well, that leads on to violence against Jews. And that is not necessarily true. I mean, we can talk about it here now, and I certainly don't feel violent towards any Jews, and I'm sure you don't either. But when we can discuss these things, we can look at that, and then we can analyze it, and then we can begin to form ways of protecting ourselves from it, defending ourselves against the immigration policy. We can analyze their arguments, see how their arguments are actually benefiting them, because they will put them in such a way as if it seems as if they're trying to benefit us. Diversity is a strength. Why wouldn't you want diversity? And of course, you know, we wouldn't want diversity because it's really a weakness. And then we can point that out. So Kevin MacDonald, I think he really does explain there that it's not a pathology, because the Jews will claim it's a pathology. It's a virus. It's just something that, for unknown reasons, just suddenly appears amongst the Gentiles. They just suddenly catch this virus of anti-Semitism and they suddenly become anti-Jews. And it's not that. What it is these policies that they have, these things that they bring into our society that negatively affect us. And if it was anybody else, we would be able to advocate against it without being told we're, you know, it's hate speech or we're somehow coming out with racial hatred. If it was any other group in society that was, you know, causing things that were negative to us, it wouldn't be a problem. But this is where they're so clever at actually doing this. I don't know whether it's just because they got this higher IQ, because we don't see the Chinese doing it. It's just something that comes naturally to them.
Yeah, there's one or two people who actually dispute the hierarchy thing, but I mean, if we take that as a fact, just for the sake of argument, and it seems true to me, there's a great many Jews who are very, very intelligent. I would add as well, they tend to, in my experience, have a very, very good work ethic, and also a low time preference. And I think, as crucial as anything else, focusing on their aims as well, having particular aims and just making sure they achieve them, even if it takes a long time. But also just this kind of teamwork across the whole across the tribe, which operates globally to a large extent. So you'll have what appear to be contrasting Jewish interests, but really they do both work to the same aim of weakening the Gentiles vis-a-vis the Jews. This is something that if you argue with people, say on social media or whatever, I don't particularly argue on this basis, but I do see others doing so. They will argue, Jews, are, what is it, more than half of the billionaires in the US are Jews, out of less than 3% of the population, and many, many other examples. They dominate this field and that field and so on. If a Jew is arguing back, they will often, in a very sort of self-congratulatory way, say, yeah, well done to us, right? On the one hand, that is quite obnoxious, because it's like, well, look, I'm not disagreeing that you've done well, but can you not see that it's bad for us? And maybe in the long term, it's also bad for you. And do you not care that it's bad for us? And if so, why should we care what's good for you? So there's that. But on the other end, I would also say that ought to be a lesson to us, right? We, much as, and we've talked about this before, the altruism and the openness and the sort of sympathy for the underdog and all sorts of traits of white people that, in contact with all these other races within our lands are actually terrible weaknesses, but we would like to maintain those things. All the same, right, we don't have a choice of what circumstances we're born into. We are living in a world, you and I were born into a Britain that was already, I would say, under, maybe not Jewish control, but was Judaized, was already thinking along Jewish lines, I would say, or Jerusalemite sort of thinking, certainly in regards to immigration and, our rights to act for our ethnic interests. We have to, whatever we would like, we do have to adapt to our situation, whatever comes naturally to us. And we are living under a sort of hostile occupation, as the Ayatollah says. And we have to up our game, or we are going to go under. We are going to face a future of horrors. And we, Jews are not wrong to say, even if they're being obnoxious about sort of congratulating themselves for it, they have achieved things that, from an alien's point of view, shouldn't be possible for such a tiny amount of people. we have to adapt. We have to do what it takes. And that, among, you know, becoming more ethnocentric, more assertive and so on, it also means we have to be smart and eugenic as well. And we have to basically have a better work ethic. We have to, you know, all sorts of adaptations to only as far as is necessary, but emulate them in the ways that they're strong. And we just have to, otherwise we will lose and we may be enslaved or God knows what. So so much as it's annoying to have that rubbed in our face, we also have to take the very unpleasant lessons from it.
Oh, that's it, yeah. Got to learn a lesson from it. That's the point of it. I think, and as I was pointing out in that bit that I said at the beginning there, it's not such a question of emulating the Jews' strategies, but reviving our own. And you mentioned like our altruism there and how it's being misused and how we'd like to keep a hold of that. Well, we need to increase the altruism towards our own. We need to be employing our own and frequenting our own businesses and having more of a sense of being British and being European and looking out for white people's interests, and also that work ethic. I mean, the British people had an amazing work ethic. We went out and conquered the world. We colonized America. We built Australia, and it was the lowest classes. It was the lowest members of the British nations that went out and built Australia. And within 100 years, they built a first world country. So, you know, we have this work ethic. It's just that we've lost this work ethic. We've lost our traditions, and as much as we've lost our place in the world and our understanding of who we are, the Jews have risen up in the world since this emancipation. They've increased as much as we have decreased. And they do say that the last century, they call it the Jewish century, because it was the century where all these Jewish ideologies made their way into society. The homosexuality, yeah. Abortion, the immigration, the diversity, all of it is Jewish ideology that's now made its way into our society and replaced our own ideology and replaced our own ways of doing things. And I think when this is explained to people, it helps them to start making changes in their own lives, to start being positive again, because that's what we need to be, is positive. We shouldn't be following these Jewish ideas. They're not good for us. They might be okay for the Jews, and that might be their idea of the utopia, but it doesn't coincide with what is best for Europeans and what is best for white people, particularly what is best for Christians. But that's been totally subverted as well.
I agree. I mean, I never let any scummy leftist deny that British people are capable of work and intelligence. I mean, like, when you see people say that the Windrush and so on and, you know, immigration in general came here because British people somehow just stopped wanting to work. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, look at the things that Britain's achieved in the past. It tells its own story. There's anyone who says that, I mean, what on earth happened in the 40s and 50s? British people suddenly just stopped being what they were before. It's ridiculous, utterly ridiculous. I would agree that, I was asked this question earlier this year. What do we need to do, just to put it as you know, what do our people need to do in as short a description as possible? It's just racial consciousness. That's what we need, or a sense of usness. And a sense of specific, you know, an awareness of the things that are particular to us. And definitely an ending of this ridiculous idea that all people are the same and that our differences are only in skin colour. No. People love to emphasise that, you know, we only differ in our DNA from the other races by some fraction of 0.001% or whatever it is. But we only differ from chimpanzees by sort of 0.003%, I think, in DNA. But, you know, their IQ is zero. We only differ from jellyfish by about 10 or 20%. So, you know, it's...
We need to remember who we are. We need to remember what our strengths are. That's the point. I think one good way to look at it is to look at the race as an extended family. And it's just like your own family, and your own family is different to the other families in the street. But your race and your nation is another extended family that is different to these other families. And, you know, talents run in families, don't they? You get families that are all good at music. You get families that are good at carpentry, families that are good at farming. And as the British people, as the British nations, we've got talents and we have strengths. And you were pointing out one earlier that gets used against us negatively, the fact that we're good traders. You know, England used to be a nation of shopkeepers. And look what's happened now. We've allowed all of the shops to be taken over by Asians. And, you now talk about the Pakistani corner shop rather than the English corner shop. These are all the sort of things that we need to remember, these strengths that we want to be capitalizing on, instead of getting caught up with Jewish entertainment and Jewish entertainment industry, getting ourselves into debt, gambling, pornography. You know, we should be building things. That's another thing we're good at doing, is building. You know, we've got amazing architecture and we've got a good work ethic where we can build houses and just create, being creators and being creative. That's other things that we can do. We need to be just concentrating on the positive things and learning about our past so that we know who we are, and not learning about our past through the Jewish lens. Because where the Jews have so much influence in the entertainment industry, whenever you learn about history from watching the television, you're going to be told that from the point of view that is pro-diversity, pro-feminism, pro-Jewish versions of history, anti-Christian, and it's going to give you a false idea of what your strengths are, because the television is going to tell you that our strengths is our welcoming, being welcoming to other races, and that's not our strengths. That is not a strength of ours. A strength of ours, you could say, was bonding with other white nations when they came here, even after they treated us badly, like the Danes and the Saxons and the Normans, and we managed to bond together as a nation. But they were white nations. They were part of our extended family. That's the difference. I think we are starting to remember our strengths, just by the way that nationalists now are like global nationalists. You know, we've got support from America, we've got support from Bulgaria, we've got support from Swiss nationalists, Swedish nationalists. All white people that are nationalists are all helping one another, and that is what is one of our strengths. And I think that shows by the way that we were able to build the British nation, as it were, the British country, from these different other white nations that came here. If you see what I mean. We did have wars with them at first, but we ended up forming a cohesive nation and a united kingdom with these people.
I agree. And I also think that one thing that complements that is the modestness of British people's attitudes. I mean, I think we're great at certain things and just sort of average at others. I mean, Britain is not known in the way that Germany or Italy was for music, for classical music. But that's okay. Like, I'll just listen to theirs and I'll appreciate it and I'll compliment it in the same way. Like, you know, and that makes us as a civilization compliment one another. We don't, you know, we're not claiming to be the best at everything. We're claiming to be part of something great, you know, and that's something that I'm happy to be, you know, happy to be part of European civilization. And I don't mind that we're different. We're different in attitude from the Italians. We're different from Germans in various ways, but that's okay. We can work together, and hopefully in peace.
Well, being humble and modest is, you know, that's a really positive trait. That is something that the British people have. They are modest, and that is something that people can do. Is just look into our past and look at the sort of people that we have and the sort of people that we have the most of. I mean, a seaman is one thing. We were very, very good at sailors and very, very good fishermen. Hopefully, the fishing industry is going to revive if we actually get to leave the EU. Without getting our fishing grounds taken from us, I mean, that is an industry that will revive, hopefully, because we have such strong fishing stocks. But there's all things in our past, I think, that can help us in our quest in the future and in our struggle. And a large part of it is just learning what our strengths are. The Jews know what their strengths are, and they know what our weaknesses are. We're starting to learn what their weaknesses are, but do we know what our strengths are? That is the important thing. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. I'm hoping you will come back in the new year where we can continue this. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back on Christmas Eve with Lady Michelle Renouve, so you can have that to look forward to. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.